So we're here at Return to the Origin, Back to the Source. And you can see from the beginning, searching for the ox and seeing the ox and taming the ox and riding home on the ox and then the ox forgotten. There's all the, this is kind of a story up until picture 8. You can see characters and it looks easily like a story. Then we get to picture 8 and there's just the symbol of the Enso. And now we are at 9, return to the origin. And then tomorrow we're going back to actually a character, not tomorrow, next week, entering the marketplace. So when we look at all of them, we can see that this number 9 seems to be a transition from the Enso, a symbol of emptiness, forgetting the self and ox, to going back to some kind of character again, a human being, which could also be part of the story. So when you look at these last three pictures, return to the origin, back to the source, it seems like this is a way of connecting from a certain kind of character or being in the preceding 7 to a new character that has integrated the emptiness. So what is this picture? So we'll go closer to the picture. Can you now see picture 9? The big picture with the verse? Okay. Now I have to find my notes. Just a second here. Let's see. Okay. So we've come to the end of the month, which focuses on picture 9 of the 10 Oxfording pictures. And many of you, maybe most of you, have looked at this picture and read this verse multiple times. You have maybe heard or read a variety of commentaries by Zen teachers as well as Sims teachers. So when I sat down to prepare my talk, my first reaction was, it's all been said, what can I say that's new? All the good ideas have been taken. But I know that I've heard some of the same Dharma over and over again, and amazingly, it can hold new understanding for me the second, the third, the 20th, the umpteenth time I hear it. In fact, I never know when an idea will shift, or maybe it's my view that shifts. And I hear myself thinking, oh, that's what that means. I think maybe I'm beginning to get it. And then sometimes I get it one way, one time, and then another way, another time, and I get it. Oh, yeah, same idea, but I get it again and again. So we're going to look at the picture again. And like I said, I was looking at the last three pictures, 8, 9, and 10, together. And it seemed like this one was a way to integrate and everything that had gone before. And come up with the last stage of this story of awakening. So I felt that picture 8 represents the stage of awakening that focuses on the process of emptying our identification with self, but that we don't want to get stuck in emptiness, in the formless. Picture 9 comes between forgetting both ox and self and the being returning to the ordinary world, in this case, the busy marketplace. So picture 9 seems to show up the paradox of how a human being surrenders the worldly self and then is able to transcend separation and form to function with one foot in the world of form, while the other foot is grounded in the absolute world of the formless. And I'm looking at the circle representing the formless. So what is the impression offered in picture nine, this in-between stage? It's nature. There's nothing dramatic to draw your attention or identification in picture nine. The picture's characterized by the qualities of simplicity and subtlety. The title Return to the Source suggests that returning to nature, to our original nature, is not complicated. And I'm looking now at the verse. Too many steps have been taken, returning to the root and the source. When we take too many steps, what do? We stop and look back from where we came. We are part of nature. We are connected to all nature. And when we study nature, we're studying the Dharma. Lindell talked about how feeling our connection to the forces of nature and to natural settings is a good way to transition from emptiness to daily life. We don't have to go far. Connecting to nature is available to us to experience directly and be a source of great wisdom, clarity, and joy. When I look at this picture, am reassured that the direction of the path is right. Just as the river's law is to flow and the flower's law is to be red, I also fit into the natural law, which is my true abode. So I'm going to close the screen share and try to find my talk again. Just a minute. Let's see here. Oh, there it is. Okay. So when I think about this stage, which I've not yet fully experienced, and that's the problem with these later stages of the Oxherding pictures and the Path to Awakening, you know, I'm not speaking from an experience of knowing this deeply. So I only have intimations, hints. But what do I take away and what can I share with you? So I sat with that question for a bit and a poem floated up. But not surprisingly, I wasn't the only one to think of this poem in connection with this picture. This is the poem by Li Po that Tuari shared last Monday. And it's very short, so I'll just repeat it since some of you weren't there. The birds have vanished down the sky. Now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains. I've heard a number of teachers share this poem over the years, and I've always had the question, how does the self disappear? I know how the birds and the clouds disappear. This is a natural thing that they do. All things arise and pass away. And I know how the self disappears at death. But the Buddha tells us that it's possible for the self to fall away in life also. And that's what the poem is about. How that happens has been a mystery to me from the beginning of my practice. But I've become more and more interested over the years in understanding how it happens. SIMS founder Rodney Smith talks about thinning the self, which makes the process more concrete and less scary. Christina Feldman, a very senior meditation teacher who founded a Dharma Center in London, talks about paying attention to behaviors she calls selfing. So selfing might be thinking thoughts like, I'm the kind of person who, or feeling, look at me, a need to be noticed and feel solid, and or control, I control this, or having feelings of belonging, this belongs to me. These are ways we thicken or solidify ourselves. We build a self-image. And when we have this solid self, we tend to cling to it and feel a need to defend it. So it's hard to surrender to life as it is, or be vulnerable with such a self to protect and perfect. And it's hard to open to our imperfect self, to see ourselves as imperfect, and open to others with compassion and understanding when we're identified with the self. But the natural and true self, as opposed to the ego self, is part of nature and offers a sense of connection, which offers a deep security and contentment that allows us to let go of selfing behaviors and cultivate thinning of the self. Another quote that was shared this month by Tim points to how we can thin the self by transcending the ego and understanding our place in nature. He quoted a short piece by Dogen, a Zen teacher. He said, "The way of the Buddha is to know oneself. To know oneself is to forget oneself, and to forget oneself is to be enlightened by all things." Nature is an equalizer. We see how the personality we've developed makes us special, but it also separates us, and it makes us feel isolated and insecure at a deep level. Whereas finding our true home in the web of life offers a deep contentment. I believe this is true, actually. But actually, knowing it is true is another thing. So I believe that's true, but I'm aspiring to really know that deeply and feel that confidence. So I'm going to describe how I've explored thinning the self and what has helped me. So I'm going to talk about something that happened to me last Monday at Tori's talk. She said, we're reaching the goal of our spiritual journey and only nature remains. She said that the process of going down the path toward awakening is not a process of self-development or self-perfecting, because it's not about selfing at all. It's not about becoming a kinder person, she said, although we will become kinder. The path is a process of seeing more and more clearly. Well, she said this right after I had been ruminating in my meditation about how I shouldn't have done something in my past that was making me feel shame in the present. And the shame was coming up strongly for me in my meditation. I was thinking about what I could do to fix the shame so I wouldn't feel bad anymore. Of course, you're probably thinking that this is not a good example of what we should be doing in our meditation. But that is why Tori's words hit me like a ton of bricks. Referring to the ox herding picture 9, she said, "There's no image of a perfected being we're trying to be in this picture. There's just nature." I'd been right in the middle of comparing myself to others who hadn't failed like I had failed. I had an image of the perfect person I wanted to be, but was not in my mind at that moment. The feeling that I needed to fix myself was painful, and seeing the image of the simple, peaceful willow tree in the picture was like taking a deep breath. It said, "Wait a minute, relax. What is the appropriate action in this moment? Is it really to compare and be harsh with myself? Or is it maybe to understand the suffering that led to this action, to be compassionate and kind? To see myself as a part of nature helps me relax into my truer self without adding any extra layers." Sharon Salzberg says, "Without the rigidity of concepts, the world becomes transparent, illuminated as though lit from within. With this understanding, the interconnectedness of all that lives becomes clear. We see that nothing is stagnant and nothing is fully separate. That who we are, what we are, is intimately woven into the nature of life. And out of this sense of connection, love and compassion arise. So that's a bit about how this picture and how it helps me feel the place of nature and my connection with nature in my spiritual path. That's something I wanted to share. The other thing I wanted to share, I'm calling the angle of view and the quality of attention, which I think also relates to this picture. I keep hearing the instruction to pay attention, not just to what I am observing, the objects like sights, sounds, sensations, thoughts, etc., but to the act of observing itself. This kind of attention can help with the thinning of the self. I recently took a day-long class from an IMS teacher, Rachel Lewis, on wise attention. And she said, we usually go out to the object of our attention, and before we know it, we can become lost in the object. That means we become identified with it or triggered by it or dazzled by it, and sometimes even addicted to it. This is another way that the self is solidified and thickened. Instead of emptying, we are filling up. These objects that fill our world have so much pull, but there is something else going on that is more subtle and has a lot less I, me, mine in it. And that is awareness. Rachel says, we need to ask, how can I work with my attention so that it is wise? And she suggests that we ask questions such as, what is the experience of seeing like for me right now? I remember when I first heard the instruction to be aware of awareness, and I thought, huh, how do you do that? The truth is that I'm still asking that question. Finally, I just started trying to move my attention away from the object to see what else I could see. When I do this, I get an intimation, you know, just a hint of something. I'm still aware of the object of my awareness, but there is something else in the space that I sense, and it is connected to my heart. Objects are very easy to be aware of. They're advertised and promoted, and they're warned about, and there are dictionary definitions of them. But it's left to each of us when it comes to being aware of awareness. We can ask questions like, what is the experience of seeing like for me right now? What am I nurturing with my attention right now? Am I going out to the object of seeing, or am I present for the experience of seeing? Ultimately, we want to have continuity of mindfulness and bring a mind of alert attention to everything, what we see and also how we see. I remember being asked by a teacher to be aware of space. The Buddha sometimes includes space as the fifth element, along with air, water, fire, and earth. And like awareness of space also feels subtle to me. But it offers good practice in attending to things that have less form and less definition. One time I was streaming a talk by Rodney Smith, our founder. The focus was on form and the formless. And he was stressing the value of the formless because it is the unconditioned, the deathless. He said, we are too attached to forms. At that moment, I was looking around my living room, feeling very gratified and content with the warmth and comfort and aesthetics of my home. My eyes were delighting in the paintings I had on the wall and the color scheme. These were all forms. And so when I heard him, I thought, what's wrong with delighting in these things? But I switched my attention. So Rodney said, pay attention to the space around the forms. And at that moment, I switched my attention away from the forms I'd been enjoying to the space around them. What I felt in that moment was that the space held the awareness, and the awareness connected me to my heart, which connected me to something much bigger and which was more valuable to me than those separate forms. Now, this doesn't always work. Sometimes I try to move to space or awareness and nothing happens. The dazzle of the objects are just too powerful. But I think the process is important. At that moment, I saw that my enchantment with my living room was like many other things I'm enchanted with, and that I needed to see that they can get in the way of a deeper contentment. When I took the class, one of the things Rachel Lewis said was that the quality of our attention nourishes the awakening factors of mindfulness. And those are investigation, energy, joy, calm, concentration, and equanimity. These factors create conditions in the mind so that the mind can do the kind of letting go that leads to liberation. And mindfulness practice, being aware of what is happening in the present moment, is the first factor. And it is the source of all the other six factors. So in conclusion, picture 9, returning to the source, appears as a scene without a story. It appears to be nothing special, possibly a willow tree, but not a specific willow tree. At the same time, it conveys a sense of nature, simplicity, and peace. And it helps us see that at the culmination of awakening, we can relax into what in us is natural, simple, and quiet. We can let go of layers of meaning and layers of becoming and just be. And I'll close with some words from Thich Nhat Hanh, and these are from his journal, Fragrant Palm Leaves. He's talking about one spiritual experience he had that revealed, and it was like the only one in his life, he said, that revealed to him how to look and listen with full attention. He said, such moments might come only once in a lifetime. They appear as ambassadors of truth, messengers from reality. If we aren't mindful, they may pass unnoticed. They may pass unnoticed. If we're distracted by all the shiny or threatening objects, which include thoughts, in our environment, we can overlook what is natural, simple, and quiet. But those things lead to our true goal, I believe. So we need to pay attention to what is more subtle and harder to see. And we have to be very quiet to do that. And we have to quiet and thin ourselves to do that. So we'll just take a moment to let the words settle. Thank you for your attention, and I hope you'll join us in discussion and breakout groups. I'm going to make some breakout rooms now. So we have a few minutes if you want to share anything about the whole experience of the Oxherding pictures in general, or this last picture. What'd you talk about in the groups? You can just unmute yourself. Jean.
I just wanted to repeat something that I said in the small group that these last three pictures, and also in the 10th one, is the phrase, "I have abandoned the whips and ropes." And it's felt to me like with that came a great expansiveness, a lot of freedom. I no longer need to control my nature with whips and ropes, that I can just let it flow. And I'm really grateful for that, because I don't thrive in a situation where there's a lot of rules and regulations, and I think self-flagellation falls right in there too. So I'm grateful for that idea that I can abandon that. So, thank you.
Thank you, Jean. And Lillian, is it you or Nikhil?
I appreciated in your talk when you were talking about your sit one time, and how you had all these thoughts coming up, and thought patterns that you don't typically try to cultivate during mindfulness. And it was just a helpful reminder of how that just happens sometimes, and we can be with that and use that as an opportunity to something else that we can work with as well. So yeah, I just appreciated that anecdote.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't very comfortable when I was feeling it, but it actually did help me see more strongly, because I had, I was in a lot of suffering and pain, and I was feeling a lot of aversion too. And so the contrast of being stuck in that, which was really just not wholesome and healthy, was actually led to something wholesome and healthy, because I could really see, whoa, what I was doing. So I think that's one of the reasons our teachers always say that difficult situations are not to be avoided, that they're to understand and to, they can lead to understanding and wise action, actually. So I thought that was a good example of it. Yeah. Anything else out there? Okay, Asus.
Something that one of the people in my group said, it keeps on going through my head about, in certain circumstances in our lives, we're at picture one and just, like, what the hell? And I think that's an okay thing. We were talking a little bit about how the story is not, it's both a story, but it's not really linear, because it goes back and forth as we do. And that was, it was both humbling and also a good reminder, and that it's okay. It's okay if we just don't know what in the world's going on in a situation. And that the path will open up. We have faith in that we can go back to picture one, and we're not going to just stay there forever. So
Yeah.
I appreciated that a lot.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you bringing that up as, kind of a reflection on the whole path and all the pictures. That was in my notes to share that, talk about that, remind us about that, but I forgot. So I'm glad you brought it up, and that the person in your group brought it up, that any of these stages can come up at any time. And for example, like the meditation that you know, I had to find my way back. I had to go back. Wait a minute. I am way off the track here. Got to go back and remember what I'm searching for, you know, what I'm looking for. So that's, thank you very much. Lyndall?
This made me think about something that came up in our group too about, you know, how there's a lot of kind of ambiguity in these oxherding pictures. And I know when we first started, I was a little uncomfortable with that, but I really appreciate it because it just sort of helps me now to sort of connect with the ambiguity and the mystery of this whole process that we go through. How it's a little different for everybody, but there's still a lot of universality to it. And just sort of that kind of incorporating that way that it feels. And it is kind of ambiguous and a little bit different for everybody and a little bit strange. And the oxherding pictures sort of say, yeah, that's how it is.
Right.
Yeah. That's very reassuring.
It is. And I remember reading that the Zen tradition likes to put ambiguity into their teaching because it forces us to not think with a linear mind all the time. It forces us to use another, you know, more of our intuitive mind or be open to don't know mind or mystery. And that is an important part of this path. Thank you for bringing that up. Okay, well, thank you everyone for participating, and Suze is going to close with some announcements.